Well, hi there, everybody, and welcome to a bonus episode, or one of the episodes where I just catch up with somebody that I've previously talked to on the podcast, and this time it's Michael Gabriel. Hi there, Michael.
Hey, Seth. How are you?
Good, good. And we're going to be talking about something that is not specifically science fiction related, but it might sound like science fiction, because about a year ago, you participated in the World Marathon Challenge. I think that's the name of it, yeah?
Yeah, that is. And it was almost exactly a year ago. Just okay. Finished 3 days ago was a year.
Nice. Well, maybe I'll try and post it on the day. but why don't you describe what exactly the World Marathon Challenge is?
So the World Marathon Challenge is it's an arranged event where a small group of people meets in one location and then begins to run around the world, by which I mean they run one marathon per day, each on a different continent, in a week. So 7 consecutive days, 7 marathons, 7 continents.
Right. The logistics of this are, that's where the science fiction comes in, because how does that even work? And so I looked into it a little bit before you were going on this, and so you all have to travel to the start, right?
Right, yeah. So we had to figure out our own solution to getting to the start. In this case, I guess really to a meeting place before the start. In this case, it was Cape Town, South Africa, is where the whole group met, and right. I hung out for a few days before we started.
Just to get over jet lag and anything like that?
And get some rest, because I certainly wasn't going to be getting much right. rest or appropriate organized food or really anything resembling mental rest either in the next week to follow.
And I guess we should circle back and say, Michael has guested on the podcast way in the early days talking about the book Dune, and then you and Mandy came on to talk about the movie when it came out, the Dune Part 1. Mm-hmm. Anything new with you, though? Podcasting or career?
Not much. Like, as I think since the pandemic, just really things slowed down a lot, and I just do a lot of running. I guess this was the big thing. Like, I kind of knew this was coming at one point and did a lot of preparation for it. And then somehow a year passed since I finished it. And wow. That kind of came by surprise.
Oh, that's on the wall behind you. Okay. Let me grab a screenshot of that here.
I can try and duck out of the way for you.
Oh, that's a great pose too, Michael.
Yeah, hiding right behind the microphone.
Yes. Your face looks like the microphone. That is definitely the picture I'm going to use. All right, cool. Yeah, so it's good to have you back. And so you travel over to Cape Town, and then what is the actual course? Like what order do you do these in? Because the logistics of it, that's where the science fiction, it sounds like. It's privately chartered?
So there's the first actual race is Antarctica, because that allows for the most potential to go wrong with regards to weather and so on before you start. But we get there by way of Cape Town, and then location 2 is Cape Town. So
right.
From location 2 onwards, and I'll go through in proper order in a minute, but from Cape Town onwards, it's one chartered plane, and they actually rotate that the company that kind of owns that plane changes crews a couple of times over the course of the week. But you can't just take a regular chartered plane to Antarctica. Right. Most people who ever go to Antarctica do it via scientific expeditions, and that's all boat. There are a few groups who are allowed to fly to Antarctica. And so our group, the person organizing it, coordinates with one of the very few groups who can do that, that is based in Cape Town. Okay. So that's a separate thing. We met in Cape Town, and we flew to Antarctica to get started on that first marathon. And that flight was in this, it's basically a modified old Russian freight craft. And so you go in, and there's kind of what we consider airline seats bolted into it. But clearly, like, what you normally see is off to your side, you see jump seats kind of on the side of it. And this thing that, there's no windows, there's no real climate control in there. It's like, it's really, really hot, but it's not like they can't just regulate it to like regular temperatures. It's really extraordinarily loud. Like, we all know that planes get loud. This is a whole nother level, because it's just not really made for us.
And how long is the flight from Cape Town?
It was, I want to say four or 5 hours, something like that.
Okay.
So it was there. I slept basically every opportunity on planes. But we flew from Cape Town to Novo Antarctica, which is short for some very long Russian word. It's a civilian research base there. And the
see, not having windows on the plane, that's how they prop up the globe Earth conspiracy, because you think you've been to Antarctica. But you really
yeah, that's
haven't.
True. Yeah, that's true. I can't really verify that. The GPS coordinates on my run could be faked.
So. Just to be clear, the position of this podcast is that the Earth is a globe.
This is also my position. I'm glad yes. we shared that. So we flew to Antarctica, and so you asked about kind of the direct course is that you go to Antarctica and back in that specific, specialized plane with that particular service. Then Cape Town is location number two. Then from Cape Town, South Africa, you go to Perth, Australia. Then I believe the longest flight of the trip is Perth, Australia to Dubai, UAE. Mm-hmm. And then from Dubai to Madrid, Spain, then from Madrid to Fortaleza, Brazil, and then from Fortaleza, Brazil to Miami, which was nice because I live in Atlanta, so it was finishing really close to home.
Yeah, yeah. And that, so you're doing this in February 2023. Yeah. So in theory, all those hot places shouldn't be super, super hot.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, because it was summer for Antarctica and summer for Cape Town, which was warm, but not nearly as bad as it gets for me in Atlanta, for instance. Mm. So,
yeah, I guess Brazil, that would be during the summer. Hmm.
So Brazil, it was during the summer, but it was kind of the northern edge of Brazil.
Yeah.
It wasn't too bad. I mean, Brazil and Australia were the worst two weather-wise.
Okay. Let's talk through them kind of one at a time. So,
sure.
Antarctica, I remember you talking about the way everything worked, because you really have to be aware of weather there and safety of the runners.
Yes.
What is the weather like in Antarctica in February?
It's a toss-up. The day before we went, we had a briefing with the man who owns the company that does the flights to and from. Mm-hmm. And he was telling us about conditions. He's like, and he was doing translating since about half of the group, maybe a little bit less, was American. He did some conversion for us to Fahrenheit just so we could kind of process. Mm-hmm. And he was telling us that, like, hey, weather's actually pretty nice. It was, only in the 30s Fahrenheit the other day. And he goes to Antarctica frequently enough that he was there in briefly in shorts and short sleeves when he went outside and that, which of course is not something I would do in 30s, right. but I've run in colder weather than that. That's not a big deal.
Sure. Sure.
That said, one of the big things about this entire trip is you learn pretty early that, because you're trying to get things done in a week span, things are like, you just don't get married to a schedule. You get ready to just go when you're told to go, sit when you're told to sit, and so on. Yeah. And we were told, like, hey, have your phones on you, be ready. Our plan is to meet back at the hotel at this time to head to the airport and go from there. But we get called in early because there's a storm coming into Antarctica and we are trying to get in and out before the storm. Mm. So we head there about, I can't remember how many hours earlier than expected, maybe 10 hours earlier than originally planned. And we land in Antarctica and it's pretty nice, actually. Like I'm bundled up and I'm getting ready to go change. They have little trailers set up on Antarctica for us to change in. And they're just, these are the facilities of the actual base. Mm-hmm. And so we go in and we're changing. And in the time we're changing, kind of a pre-storm starts to hit. And so when I land, it's the calmest thing I've ever seen. It's just, there's nothing. It's probably in the 20s Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Not that, I mean, I've dealt with worse. I don't like cold, but I can deal.
Yeah.
And by the time we start running, wind has started, cloud cover has come over, temperature has dropped immensely. And I never got a full-on weather, a full-on just a regular air temperature reading. But I know that my understanding is with wind chill, that was down to minus 20s, minus 30s.
Oof. I've run in that before. That is not fun.
I have not. So that was new to me. But it was specifically... it was the wind and snow, and I don't know if the snow was actually new snow or if it was just existing snow being blown around because mm-hmm. there's so much of it there. But we had steady winds of 20 to 30 miles per hour and gusts of up to 50 pretty consistently throughout the, running 26 miles or 42 kilometers. So the fascinating thing is kind of the course change. So originally it was supposed to be big loops around the, I was going to say tarmac, but that's not accurate, around the landing strip. And because, but that's ice. It's not like there's no, you know,
right. Right.
They haven't actually like paved a tarmac or anything there. Mm-hmm. But because vision was so bad or visibility was so bad, they've kind of modified it to be an out and back where we were kind of crossing right by each other, mm-hmm. and kept us pretty short distance away so that if anything happened, somebody could get to us pretty quickly, which is something that's important to do. Yeah. Whereas when visibility was great, I mean, it's not like there were hills, so you could see a really long way. Mm-hmm. So we did, if my memory serves me, I want to say it was 10 laps out and back. So 20 of the same stretch, basically. Mm-hmm. So a little over a mile each, a little over a mile each direction. And without wind, you could definitely see much further than that. But with wind, I mean, it was, you would get a quarter of a mile and you'd turn your head around. You'd be like, where did the plane go? The giant plane that's right there. Yeah. Like, I know it's there. I can't see it. And it was just like roaring wind in one direction and then utter silence in the other direction in your ears.
Right.
Pretty quickly got to the point where it was like, oh, okay. Like I'm going to be basically head down marching in one direction.
Yeah.
And the other direction, you're like trying to cheer on the other runners and they can't hear you at all.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, that person is apparently saying something to me.
Yeah.
It was a fun time. And just like the, for me, and you know, you lived in Alaska for mm-hmm. a long time and so on. So you're probably much more familiar with this than I am, but something about this is like running purely on ice. Like there is no road anywhere. I mean, you look down, it's clear ice. You can see for feet down. It's just blue ice. Mm. And you're like, okay, well, I'm going to get on that. And then you immediately start to slide, even if you have trail shoes or whatever.
Yeah.
So you're like, okay, that's not what I want.
You
want
to be on packed snow. Yeah,
exactly. And so for those of us who are not used to this, we were figuring that out, right? So like there's the fluffy snow you don't want to get on because you just sink into it. And that's a bunch of extra effort. So you want to get on the packed snow. The problem is the packed snow is also on ice. Yeah. And so it's sliding around. So you're like trying to find, like when you hear crunch, you're like, okay, cool. Let me continue on that section of ice.
Yeah.
But like you still don't have a whole lot of stability. So this is marathon one of seven, you know, in 7 days. And I'm like, wow, the sides of my legs are really getting a workout.
Yeah. Kind of like running on the beach in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
But a little less predictable.
Right.
Substantially less predictable.
And that was the fun thing is like each lap you would kind of see, you're like, okay, where's the ice this time? Because you would kind of sort of like hunt for where the ice had moved. And I entertained myself by just kind of like scanning the horizon and being like, okay, that is my favorite rock on Antarctica. And that's my favorite giant snowdrift in Antarctica. And like, cause this is not fun otherwise.
Yeah. Were you wearing like goggles, like ski goggles or anything like that?
Was it
snowing? Was there precipitation?
So there was definitely like snow in our faces and you can see it in some of the photos, depending on kind of the angle of the photos. And the wind was harsh enough and cold enough, of course, that you wanted something like that. I really considered buying full on ski goggles and I just couldn't justify it because I would never have an occasion to use them otherwise.
Right.
So, but I was fully bundled up. Like I had multiple layers. I had even flown to Indiana in December to run a race with friends to test out the gear I had bought. And but I had kind of sunglasses on and otherwise when I was going into the wind, I had like a balaclava and a wrap around my neck and a wrap around my mouth that I would bring up and down. And I had a hat over the balaclava. So it was, I was really, really covered. Like you can maybe see a tiny bit of skin poking out.
Yeah.
And then when I was going not into the wind, like I would, when I was going with the wind, I would just pull the mask down and kind of, just so I wasn't like sucking down the moist air from inside the mask the entire time.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. And do I remember that you said that at some point the course had to be shortened as well?
So it was shortened before we started because they knew the visibility was going to do it. So there were no modifications once we were going. We had a set course. The group, the guy who does it is he's been plugged into the international circle. So he's whatever certifications you need to be able to do that, he has. So he kind of measured things out before we started while we were all changing and stuff. He's like, all right, here's the new modified course since we know we're getting inclement weather. And so on. And that just meant we saw each other more, which was nice. And it also meant that, So we needed a warming tent in order for our fuels and so on to sit there.
Yeah.
And it meant hopping into that warming tent each lap. And like, I would take off my mittens and then use my gloves to like drink and eat. And and it's funny, of course, because who knows how cold inside the warming tent was. It felt really warm, but it was not, because they had gummy bears for one of the fuel options. And I remember popping some in my mouth. I was like, I can't chew this. It's like solid. Yeah. It's like a block of ice. And it's in the center of the like the warmest place here.
Right. Well, it's amazing too, just the difference that it makes being out of the wind.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. So what's a good marathon time for you?
So that depends. When I've been in peak shape, which I'm at the early stage of trying to get back into, my personal best was 3:13, and I did not race that day. I was training. Okay. I would say that probably a good quarter or more of my marathons are under 3:30. Okay. And most of those I ran comfortably, not like at a race effort.
Okay.
At the time when I started the challenge, I could have probably pretty comfortably run one in the 3:40, 3:45 range, but felt it kind of the next couple of days.
Gotcha.
Right.
And you got to pace yourself when you're doing seven.
Yeah. Pace yourself. And it was Antarctica, and it was already, so a bunch of us discussed that for many of us, that was the hardest single marathon we had ever done. And that was day one of seven.
Right.
So, so I ran that one in close to 6 hours, I want to say, 5:40, something like that, 5:50. Okay. So, it was pretty rough. To give you an idea, so the guy who won the entire thing, he won every single day. He won that day. He's a professional runner, ultra marathoner, so on. David Kilgore, he lives in New York, I'm pretty sure he did this being sponsored by Red Bull, and he did that first day in 3:20. And I remember thinking on the first lap, looking at him and be like, oh no, we're in trouble. Because I recognize the pace that he is running just at a distance as something I've run. Like the way he looks right now is something that I know my body is capable of doing. That means we're going slow because he can do things that I absolutely cannot conceive. Right. Mm-hmm. So that kind of just sets the mode. And that was by far, I think every other day he did at least 30 minutes faster than that. Okay. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, once you get that one in the books, then, I guess I didn't ask how many people are participating in this.
This was
as runners, that is.
Yes, as runners, it was. I believe it was a group of a hair over 40 total, and this was, I believe, the first time where they introduced a half marathon option. So I think some, like either 10 or a dozen of them did half marathons each day,
okay.
Whereas the rest of us did full marathons.
Okay. Nice. And then a bunch of support staff, I imagine.
Yes. Some support staff traveled with us from location to location, and some were,
in place at each place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To help with kind of build up and tear down before we started and arrangements needed as schedules shifted.
Nice. So then you finish Antarctica, and how much time? I imagine that as soon as the last person's done, are you all back on the plane and heading back for Cape Town?
Yeah, pretty much. So one of the things is the experience was very different for people at the very front versus the people at the very back of the group. As the week went on, and just because time is tight. And so people at the front can have potentially hours to rest and recover and shower and, stuff like that at subsequent locations, whereas people in the back do not have that kind of time. And that pressure got that time pressure got tighter and tighter and tighter as we went over the course of the week. So for me, I had just enough time to kind of go change back into my travel clothes, out of my running clothes, get a little bit of stew that the people there had made us. They had some lamb stew waiting for us. And I realized my stomach just didn't really want it, which is definitely a thing a lot of us could relate to over the course of the trip. Sometimes, you only had one food option and your body didn't want it. So you tried to get it down and that hurt over the course of the week.
I mean, I can relate to that just after doing a 10K, and now it's 9 o'clock in the morning and they're offering burgers and beer. And I'm like, no, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of those things where too, when a lot of your sleeping and eating is on flights, and sometimes the flights turnarounds are so tight that they don't have time to replenish the food they have on board. And so they're like, you're just eating what you're like, it's, I know my body says it's breakfast and you're offering me, baked fish. I can't right now. I'll try my best, but
yeah.
And of course, none of us, you can't eat enough calories in that environment to maintain over the course of a week. So we're all seeing ourselves like drop weight over the course of the week, just which makes things harder as the week goes on as well. So
yeah. So now you're back to Cape Town for this second one, and you've already been wandering around Cape Town for part of a week.
Yeah. So back in Cape Town, and it's the first time we hit some logistical hiccups. So originally the plan was we were going to get back to back from Antarctica, and original schedule before Antarctica moved forward in time a bit because to beat the storm in and out. And we did beat the worst storm that would have stranded us in Antarctica. So it is good that they made that change. We got hit by like a pre-storm storm, but the bad multi-day storm we got out ahead of. So originally we were not even going to, like, we were going to have 2 hours after landing and then start running in Cape Town, which would have been pretty rough. But instead they're like, hey, you know, go back to your hotels, get a night's sleep. I mean, a short night's sleep, but like 6 hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, show up right here on the beach in the morning. Or not the beach. They had a really beautiful running trail, right, kind of just off the beach, kind of similar to a boardwalk, but it was like a legitimate, really nice,
path. Trail.
Yeah. And so we show up to that, and it's much, much, much warmer in Cape Town than it is in Antarctica.
Yeah.
And some people had already gotten sunburned from just hanging out. And there I tan really easily. So I'd gotten like a dark tan from it. And I don't use sunblock nearly as much as I should. I was using sunblock, right? Because it's like, it's warm enough and I'm
got Egyptian blood, man. I don't need that.
Yeah. and I'm running in shorts and short sleeves and so on. Which actually what I'm running in is something we'll get to in a second. So we start at our normal time, but we've also heard that they are running into logistical issues with our flight out of Cape Town, because ideally they're like, you know, we should only have a couple of hours of rest after the race to like shower, change, meet at a central hotel, and then take the bus to the airport.
Yeah.
But the problem is, and people have done this a number of times, and they're like, we sent them all the paperwork for our flight weeks ago, and someone somewhere has not stamped the form that needs to be stamped for us to leave. And so we're trying to get that figured out. But we will communicate more with you after the race and we'll figure it out. So hang tight. And so we're like, oh, no. I mean, more rest is nice, but also more rest now means less rest later. Right. So, so we go into the Cape Town race knowing this, and we run around, and this was the most support we had anywhere, because they had kind of the local Cape Town, some local Cape Town running club. They had people at like volunteers out just directing traffic for parking lots, because we were doing this in the middle of the day, making sure that, you know, nobody was making sure that we could easily cross areas without having to kind of stop for cars, that sort of thing. There were lots of people just out and about who were kind of watching and saw us that we had race numbers on and were doing laps, and so they were cheering and so on. That was a lot of fun. Of course, you know, I'm American. We get weird about people's accents. And so it was fun having South Africans cheer for us. And then something we hadn't mentioned is I have a reputation for running in costume, running races in costumes. And that's just a thing I've built up over the years. And I don't do it for every race. I kind of pick and choose. And I was like, well, I'm only going to do this thing once in my life, so I've got to do this in costume, right? I packed for all of my outfits, not just my running outfits, but like low-key simple costumes for every single day. And I was having a hard time figuring out my theming, and I settled on a native animal per continent. So it was really fun hearing kind of South African people, especially because, you know, you'd have like a little child at a park with his grandmother or something, and the grandmother would go, look at the zebra, because I was dressed as a zebra for Africa. And so that was a lot of fun. And the people, the volunteers, were giving us high fives and so on, especially when they're like, how many laps do you have left? And when we're on the last one, they would give us high fives the whole way in.
Nice.
So a lot of fun.
Yeah. So if anybody doesn't follow Michael on Instagram, you can see a lot of them are from like 5Ks at Disney.
Yeah, so Disney World, well, now Disneyland as well, they do races, but it's actually, they'll do in a given weekend multiple races in a weekend, and I tend to sign up for all of them if I go down for a race. So so they'll do like a 5K on Friday, a 10K on Saturday, and a half marathon on Sunday, and I'll do them all like back to back. And then in January, they have a full marathon. So they do a 4-race sequence. And I do that every year as well. So, okay. So I'll do like 3 races in a weekend, ranging from 5K to half marathon or even full marathon in costume. Right.
Sometimes dressed as Princess Jasmine. Or
yeah. Yeah. My claim Aladdin. To fame that actually got me a lot of, and that is its own community. That's called the Run Disney community. And the thing that kind of put me on a lot of people's radar down there is I won the Disney Princess 5K 1 year dressed as Rapunzel. and that just, a lot of people have kind of seen me since then. And I've just made a lot of friends in the corrals and gotten other people to do costumes too. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's very cool. I have to imagine there has to be some consideration taken for a costume that doesn't chafe.
Yeah. So I have grown to, now one of the big things that anybody who does distance running will hear over and over is nothing new on race day.
Right.
I am very much an advocate for that. And this is very much a do as I say, not as I do situation. Because I do new things on race day all the time. Yeah. For this one, though, I knew that no matter what, my bottom level layer, anything actually touching my skin, needed to be something I was intimately familiar with running with. Mm. Like I had run long training runs or races in before, or had something identical that I'd run in, and it was just a new color in the same thing, right? And these were also much simpler costumes because I was going to have to not just do it 1 day or 4 days, but 7 marathons in a row.
Yeah.
I don't make a lot of allowances for comfort at other races because I know I can deal with anything, but I didn't I believed I could get through 7 marathons in 7 days and all this, but I didn't have the same kind of confidence I normally do. So, chafing is kind of the number one thing. I brought a bunch of stuff with me. I swear by Body Glide, but which is one of many products that's just you rub it on all the spots that touches material as you're running. But also I brought like moleskin with me that I could, if something did start to chafe, I could just slap it on and leave it for the rest of the week if I needed to. Right. Yeah. And, very attentive to that. And they of course had kind of at the aid tent. Not only did they have fuel and stuff like that for us, in addition to whatever you brought for yourself. But they had all kinds of, Vaseline and similar things, specialty products, things to try. We had a doctor on staff, of course. And there's like, hey, if you're starting to have problems, tell us early and we'll make adjustments. Thankfully I did not run into any real issues. Everything that I had brought with me, I kind of prepared for it. So
awesome. So then, what was your costume for Perth?
I was a kangaroo and I had a little, and it was very, very simple, but, to kind of make it pop. So I had ears, and just kind of an appropriately colored outfit, but then I had a little like Joey. So just like a baby kangaroo that I had tucked into my running belt. And I did have to shift that around a little bit cause I could feel it. Like if I let it stay in the one spot for 26 miles, that was definitely going to turn into some chafing. So,
yeah.
So it kind of shifted a little bit of cross where on my waist it was sitting for the duration.
Nice. So how was Australia for running? So
Australia was pretty cool. It was the opposite of cool. It was very hot, but it was pretty cool, in terms of just the experience. So we landed and I want to say it was 100 degrees Fahrenheit when we first landed, but we knew that when we were running, we were going to be running starting pretty close to sunset. And so temperature was going to drop pretty quickly. Yeah. And it wasn't, despite being close to water, it was really not that humid, certainly not compared to what I'm used to.
Yeah.
So, I'll take dry heat over humid, any day.
Yes.
For running, especially, cause at least your sweat is doing something for you, so when we went to Perth, it was pretty quick. Like we landed and we took a bus to the West Australia Marathon Club, which hosted us. And so that was really, really nice because they hosted us and prepared a barbecue for afterwards.
Mm.
And they treated us, there were fewer people supporting than the South Africa one, but the kind of support they had was ridiculous. They treated us like professionals. Mm. Every single one of us had our own numbered spot on a table where we could put our own personal stuff in addition to the support, like the, just, the fuel and snacks and so on that they would have for us. So we kind of had our own numbered station instead of being like, okay, I'm going to stick my pack right here next to the tent. So on each lap, I'm going to, hunt down my pack and get a thing out. It was really, really nice.
Yeah.
They had been kind of told all their members and other people in the community around that this was happening. So they had people showing up. I actually had through an online virtual running Facebook group that I'm a member of and like have acquaintances through someone there who I knew vaguely through there, who was a member also like knew that this was happening and where it was happening. And so she went there as a volunteer and was there at our lap turnaround and was like giving me high fives. And we took a selfie and she submitted it in this completely independent Facebook group. So it was like neat to have this kind of thing happening. Very thankful that the sun went down so quickly after we landed, because it actually got very pleasant for me, at least. You know, I'd run in Atlanta, and sure, it was winter here, but like I'm used to our summers. So that was great. The path was beautiful. It was the running path that they have right by the club. And it was just this really beautiful path, like going by a bridge and the water and just really, really gorgeous scenery. There's people cheering for us, and we finished. And so one thing I didn't mention is, you know, as part of the travel thing and the logistics of this, you know, we're going into and out of regular airports, and you're carrying all your own bags, which you have for the time before and the time after and the challenge, right?
Yeah.
And so I have two suitcases and two carry-on, like two. So I like a backpack and then like a sling bag. And you're carrying all of those in each location while your body is getting more and more tired as you go. And anybody who's run long distances knows, like, you use your core and your back a lot when you run. And so that gets worn down as well. And so I was lifting one of my bags up off the bus when we arrived in Perth. I felt something go like pop in my back. And I was like, well, that's not good.
Yeah.
And I just had this terrible knot in my, like, really, really sharp pain in my lower back. This is going into marathon 3, and we started the race like 20 minutes later. So I felt that when we started, and it loosened up maybe like a quarter of the way into the race. It didn't go away, but it was like, okay, well now it feels a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And that became a theme for the week, is we would all talk about the pains we were feeling. And we're like, okay, as long as the pain keeps moving, you're fine. It's time to start getting alarmed as if the pain stays in the same spot.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of pains for me.
Mm-hmm. So then you got to did you say the longest flight was from Perth to Dubai?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, I don't know if folks know, you know, if you're in the United States, where Perth is in Australia, but it's kind of southwest.
Yes. Yeah. Like western edge essentially of Australia.
Yeah.
And that was, it made it a close flight to Cape Town, relatively speaking. And then also we went westward from there to Dubai. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and we had to, so Australia has rules around how long a plane has to be grounded before the same plane can leave. I'm pretty sure it's around labor laws and like flight crews and so on.
Yeah.
So we had to stay there for a certain number of hours. And so we stayed there for basically exactly that amount of time before flying to Dubai. And by the time we got to Dubai, we knew like we're on a time crunch. We're getting in and out as fast as we possibly can.
Yeah.
So we land and we get on a bus. And at this point, like I'm sleeping every minute that I can on planes, but I'm telling whoever is sitting next to me, if they bring food by, wake me up. Like I need sleep, but I also need food. Like I'm not getting through the week without food, you know? So the only time I was awake really was, and thankfully I do fall asleep on planes pretty easily. That doesn't mean well, but like, you know, but I'm at least getting as much sleep as I can, even if it's not good sleep.
Right. Well, three marathons deep, I imagine that helps with the sleep as well.
Yeah, it does. It does. So fell asleep there. And then on the plane, we land and I'm immediately out when we get on the bus to our, so I could not tell you how long the bus ride was from the airport in Dubai to the, where we ran, which was Jumeirah Beach in Dubai. And this was a fun experience. So we land and we arrive at essentially like a hotel that we had a really large house suite thing booked for the group. Mm-hmm. The hope was, if things had not gotten off the rails immediately with regards to schedule, that we were actually going to get a night to stay there. That was not going to be the case now. We knew that we were going to be rushing to start the race and then to get back to the airport once we finish the race. So we land and they're like, you know what, everybody, toss your stuff on the outside of the hotel. We will take your stuff inside. Just make sure that your stuff is together. And we're going to make sure bags are near kind of other people's bags as we go, or like near the bags that are next to them. So we did that. We crossed the street within 20 minutes. We were starting on this outdoor track that was on the beach. And really, really cool thing that they had there is it was an outdoor track that had every 100 meters marked on it.
Oh, okay.
Which worked out really well because a marathon is 42.2 kilometers. So we did a, and we were starting right, you know how like there's sunset, but then you have all that twilight period, right?
Yeah.
So like it's still light. That was essentially when we started, was during that twilight period. Hmm. But it was well lit with artificial lights afterwards. And we did a 1 kilometer stretch out and back. Wow. Yeah. So 21 laps or 42 times doing the stretch. But the very first lap we did 1 kilometer out, 1 kilometer back, and then they made us do 100 meters the opposite direction
to get the
and
point
back
two.
To get the point two on the first lap. Okay. And then we continued the rest of it. And that was fun. I did this as a panda for Asia. I really tried to think of something specific to Dubai, but like,
yeah,
anything that I could think that would make more sense for that was more Middle East, which includes like Africa and so on. And so, plus it's not like you could see camel humps if I was running and I wanted things visible, recognizable from the front. So we did that. And that was really fun for me because, so my family is from Egypt and I know Arabic. Not super, super well, but like Egyptian Arabic I know well. And then other dialects, it kind of depends.
Yeah.
And so it was fun to just hear random people talking in Arabic and be like, well, I definitely can't figure out what they're saying. And then everyone was like, there's an Egyptian here somewhere. Like that was, okay. I understood that entire bit. So, awesome. Cause Dubai is a very international city. So there's people from all over. Right.
Yeah.
So that was fun. And they had a local, it was another local running club that was just supporting us at the turnarounds with, you know, extra fuel options and so on. And they were cheering for us in English and so on. And it wasn't until the very last lap that I went and like said something to them in Arabic and and so on. And they're like, what? It's like, oh yeah, sorry, I didn't tell you. But, because like by then we knew each other's names too. And so we're just chatting with them.
That's cool.
And so that was fun. So finished that. And up to this point, this was day marathon 4.
Yeah.
And I think including this, I had gone faster every day and felt better, like same effort or actually less effort, but going slightly better, just kind of like my legs loosening up into it and so on, and kind of maintaining my effort. And originally, like a kind of lofty goal was to do that all week long.
Yeah.
So I finished this feeling that
negative split the whole thing.
Exactly. Yeah. That was my, that was kind of a goal that I had, you know, we set goals, and sometimes they land, sometimes they don't. So,
So now you're over that. The hump, right? Because this is day 4 of 7. So,
yeah. And so I finished this actually feeling really good. End of day 4 is probably the best I felt the entire time, like at the end of a race, and was, I believe, my fastest time of the week. So I felt really good, and finished. But by this point, we're kind of on a tight turnaround, and they're like, hey, one bus has already gone to the airport. You need to go in, run into the hotel, find your bags, shower, and we're going to be on such a tight turnaround in the next two locations that we need you to swap things around in your bags so that your carry-ons have everything you need for the next two places.
Mm.
And we're like, okay. So I don't think I've ever unpacked and repacked bags that fast in my life.
Yeah.
You know, it was like 5 minutes, unpacked, repacked, showered, downed some pizza they had waiting for us, got on the bus, and then waited for the last couple of people, last few people to finish. And the idea was don't be getting ready while other people are. Like, we want you out of the way for other people who are finishing afterwards. And so once everybody was ready, they got on the bus, we went to the airport, and we flew to Madrid.
Okay.
So
one of the things that, like, when I think of marathons, right, I think of like city marathons. So Boston, Seattle, Portland, and that, you know, Chicago, that where they just go like through the city and that kind of stuff. You're not really doing that for
these, right? We're not seeing anything. We're doing laps, which for anybody who does long distances and even people who do short ones, I know the reaction I get from lots of people is like, oh, that sounds miserable. And that used to be true for me, but I've done enough lapped races that you start to realize like sometimes it's helpful, especially for something like this, where it's going to be such a mental, like, don't get me wrong, I prefer the giant races with lots of crowd support and going and like beautiful scenery or getting to explore a city. But for something like this, it was, So I did a 50 miler years ago, and in that I learned a kind of my own mental technique for getting through like slogs.
Yeah.
And it's really a periodic regular check-in, and regular, I mean like time regular, like truly time regular, not just, when I feel like checking in with myself and being like asking myself kind of where am I at physically now? How do I want to feel at the end? What adjustments do I need to make now? Like, and I am pretty good at making those adjustments and kind of really understanding if I change this effort here, that is going to make a difference between me feeling like A or feeling like B. Right. And, and I've gotten pretty good at that. And laps, when you're doing something like this, are a really useful thing. Cause instead of me trying to set a thing on my watch and getting beeped at every, however many, you know, minutes, I can be like every lap, I'm just going to do a mental check-in.
Yeah.
And since I'm going to stop on this kind of thing versus if I'm racing a race, even a marathon, I don't stop. I like plow through the water station, take the water on the go and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing that for this. I'm stopping at each station, taking my time, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, all right, well, while I do that, ask myself those questions and then start the next lap with whatever slight change I need to make. Right. So it was really helpful in this case, but yeah, I certainly didn't see the locations. Yeah, I saw Cape Town and Antarctica for what they are and nothing else.
Yeah. Cause I remember, I think I commented to you, you know, what a cool way to see the world, you know, just like you were talking about doing like the Berlin Marathon or something.
I'm
that's great, you know, to be able to do that kind of stuff. But in some of these cases, yeah, you're technically there, but you're not necessarily getting the full experience of Dubai.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did, like you said, I've done the Berlin Marathon, the London Marathon. I did the Athens Greece Marathon. I saw those cities for real.
Yeah.
Both during the race and before and after, you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now you're on to Madrid.
Yeah. So we're on to Madrid, so this was probably the single biggest race change that we had. Our original scheduled location was actually on a Formula One race course. But our time block had slipped. So, and this is one of the reasons why, like, the average person, like, you know, you think about logistics, and we're talking about logistics of travel, but it's not just logistics of travel. It's logistics of organizing the race courses, making sure that you have them when you're there, knowing
that's why
they're
not through the city, right?
Right. Exactly. Knowing that your times are going to shift and you have to have flexible options, making sure that you're going to have the people supporting there, even if your times shift that like, right. So having backup options and so on. So in this case, essentially like they were figuring things out. We didn't have, internet on the flight, so they were figuring things out while we were on the ground in Dubai, figuring out like what is our backup for Spain. And so we say Madrid, but it was really a small village in kind of, I don't know what the structure of Spain is, but the equivalent of a state is. So it was like right outside Madrid is where we ended up going to do it, because we didn't get to do the Formula One race course, which at first I was like, oh great, like I feel like a Formula One race course, you know, is made for cars. It might not be great for our legs. Like, who knows? We did not get an improvement in that respect, though. So we went to this town outside whose like mayor was really excited, and they were hyping it up because it's just a small town. And turns out this place was at high elevation. And it also, so they were very excited and really rolled everything out for us. So we stopped at their athletic center, and then we walked to the town center to race start. And so the course was essentially going to be run from the town center back to the athletic center, and then from there do a big loop around several city blocks that did not include that initial leg until we were done. And that was like 32 or 33 loops. So they basically had this giant, huge paper spreadsheet where they were tallying for each of us as we were going through and doing another lap. And that was extremely like the hills were so steep going up and down. And these were not roads that you would normally run on. So there were like, you know, potholes and so on. So this is probably one of this particular marathon, this was day 5, it was pretty high elevation. And you know how like the sun can really affect people at high elevation. And and by this day, people are several days in. Some people have kind of the sunburn from Cape Town settling in, and then we're getting into this, and we're doing it like kind of peak sun of the day. And you have all that kind of the hill climbing and hill dropping, which going down hills is also kind of rough on you, right?
Yeah.
So multiple people wiped out. I think 4 or 5 different people fell at various points, 2 of whom actually needed like medical attention when they did it, but everybody finished. And I want to say this is probably my single highest elevation gain and loss marathon that I've ever done. And this was on day 5, right? So, yeah. so I definitely, like, once I did one lap, I was like, oh, okay, I'm not negative splitting anymore. I'm done with that. Mm-hmm. The goal is to finish this feeling the way that I need to finish, feel at the end, right?
Yeah.
And that's it. So I need to feel okay. I need to feel like I've got at least 2 more marathons in me. that's it. So I backed off. I did quite a bit of walking up some of the steepest uphills because I was just like, this is not worth powering through this. If this was one uphill, fine. But I have like 30 of these, 30 yeah. something of this same uphill. So I'm not doing it. So that was rough. There's at least one guy who started to blister from the sun at this point, just to give you an idea of how rough kind of that went. And but the Spaniards who were there were awesome. They were really great support, just really, really, really nice. And again, they were not expecting this. This was like overnight decided by their mayor to welcome us in, and they were all just excited and so on. And and we had a really cool race start because they inflated. They had just at the town just had their own little inflatable start line, and they did that, and they brought out their flag and so on. And I was dressed as a bull for this, and one of my friends on the trip, because I became friends with a bunch of these people, and actually she's the one person I actually knew going into this for a prior event, and she their town flag was just like bright red, and she kind of like checked and made sure like this is not disrespectful, right? And they're like, no. And so she did the like kind of did the thing like she was a matador and I was a bull going through it. And it's great, 'cause like we have a little video snippet of that. So that's fun. We also realized like before the race start, somebody offered to take a picture and then like said like ready, set, go. And we're like, oh, that was the mayor.
Oh, nice.
So he's the one who took a picture of us and did the, like, you know, did the starting gun for us and so on. So it was a lot of fun.
Cool. So now you're almost in the home stretch back to the Americas anyway, to Brazil.
Yes. Although I do have to give a shout out to, so one of my former coworkers, actually a former manager and coworker, she's half Spanish, and her mom is from Madrid, and she's like, oh, Michael, while you're there, if you get into the airport and you have time, make sure you go buy this sandwich stand. It's not just like airport food. It's one of the best sandwiches you will have. I was like, okay. And so, you know, thanks to her, I went and dragged a few of my group with us as we were going to the airport to leave. And that was probably the best meal I had all week. So
nice.
It was a great idea.
Cool.
So then we get on the flight to Brazil. And this is another one of those. We land, we immediately just get on a bus. We start, and we go to, this is like peak heat of the day, high humidity on the beach in Fortaleza, Brazil. This is the hottest and roughest conditions we've had all week. And my costume is also the least comfortable for it. So I did a macaw, just the tropical bird, and I cut down a onesie for it. So it was like thick onesie material, like granted, not a whole onesie, but like was still, that's the material I had draped over my head and my full arms and like touching my back and so on.
A little extra insulation, just in case.
Exactly.
You needed it.
Exactly. Now that said, like the random people, so there were so many people out there cycling and running on the trail because we were there peak of the day rather than, you know,
after sunset.
Yeah. After sunset, early, which I think the original schedule had us there at kind of a time where there wouldn't have been much sun. This was another one of those. So we had, I think it was, I want to say it was 13 laps. So it was almost exactly like kind of a mile each way.
Yeah.
And they had like truly just above ice cold water. Like they had these disposable cups that had like you would rip off the vacuum seal, almost looked like a boba tea kind of situation, but with a big handle on the top so you could pour it off. They had those inside giant bins, and like it was really cold water, and they had that at each station on both ends. So every single lap I would basically take that and pour, like lift my lift the hood of the onesie and dump half of it on me. And you know, like there's when you pour Like when you get like a sudden shock of cold and you're really hot and like your body just like just exactly that reaction, that just kind of your whole body just, you cannot control the response. Mm-hmm. I got that every single time. I was like, good, it's appropriately cold. Like yes. I needed that. So I did that every single lap, but it was very pretty, but very rough, very hot. And of course, like just the everything is starting to get to me physically. And like I had said, you know, before, I'm really good at doing that mental check-in at each lap and making adjustments that I need to. And I've been making the adjustments, like going faster the first 4 days. I still think I handled myself perfectly fine. Like I felt exactly how I needed to feel at the end of each of those. And then the fifth day, slowing down, I felt how I needed to. I wanted to do the same thing here, but I knew we were so tight on time and they were talking to us as we were going. And I was getting wind of the fact that like starting to feel like, oh, they might tear down the finish line before I'm done if I go at the pace that I should go at, like to be responsible.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean I wasn't going to finish and get a time, but like I wanted to finish with that finish line up. I wanted to get the picture. And so I had to make a choice to do the you know, quote, irresponsible thing, as if this trip was responsible, right? But like, you know, to be irresponsible and be like, no, I'm going to run faster than I should. And so I made the conscious choice to pick up that pace and definitely suffered the consequences as I went. So thankfully, this whole time, like there were local athletes who just like stopped doing their own running thing and just started cheering us on. And there was this group of guys who, because of my outfit, they got really into it. They were just like asked if they could record. And I was like, yeah, sure. But then they would start to like make bird sounds and stuff whenever I would pass. It was a lot of fun and like flap their wings and their arms as they were wings and stuff. And like mile 18, almost exactly mile 18, my left leg just shooting pain that I'd never felt before in my left leg. I was like, what is happening? I can barely put weight on my leg right now. I don't know what to do. So thankfully, that was not that far. Like I kind of walked in that lap, went to the doctor and was like, hey, look, I've never taken pain medication for a race, for running, for anything like that. I'm allergic to ibuprofen, NSAIDs, all that stuff. Do you have something that I can use? Because I'm going to get through this like one way or the other. Right. And he's like, so you can take Tylenol and stuff like that. And I was like, yep. And then he's like, all right, well, this is insert some drug that his name I don't know. But he's like, you can take this. I was like, great. Took it. And then kind of continued. And within a pretty short time frame, that sharp pain in my left leg became like I was vaguely aware that there was a dull feeling there. And I was like, all right, like
the volume at least turned down. Huh?
Yeah. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to run whether or not I should, I'm going to run the rest of this. And so I kind of ran in the rest and finished. It's like, if I have to do that for the last one, I have to do that for the last one, but like nothing's going to stop me from finishing it. So,
yeah.
So I did finish, while the finish line was still up. So I'm glad I made the decision I made. But this point, I think just being in that state, like I got really emotional. So I was doing a thing where I was kind of updating Instagram regularly. Lots of people were following me and supporting me, from, you know, all over, people I knew, people I didn't know. And I started to do like one of the Instagram stories where I was talking about it. I was like, yeah, so I'm sixth one down. And I was like starting to talk about how I feel. And the next thing I know, I'm starting to cry. And I was like, I was not like, okay, I guess that's how I feel right now. And it was, you know, just everything. Cause I was feeling like bad about pushing harder than I wanted to. And then I was thinking about the people who were going to finish without the finish line and, you know, and all that. So then we like get on the bus and things really got messy at the airport. Cause like most of us did not have time to shower. So we went to the airport gross after the roughest one that we had. And I of course was wearing this big macaw thing. So I had sweat so much, just felt disgusting. Thankfully, like we all had, like many of us had body wipes and stuff like that. So like I went into the bathroom at the airport and like
a little,
I did. Yeah. I mean, it was not a replacement for a shower, mind you, but like it was better than nothing for sure.
Yeah.
And so I was able to like change into other clothes and not like get on the plane in my running clothing, and so on. But, we also had an issue where like, because the next flight was coming into America and we know what, what it's like for people traveling into America and all the paperwork and so on. And we had many, many, many people who are not American on the flight. And so we ran into so many logistical hiccups and so on with that. So we would have had time to shower if we had known what time we were going to be forced to sit in the airport, but we didn't know. So we're just sitting there kind of in my head. I'm like, I'm just sitting there in my filth when I could have showered,
right?
While also losing more time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that was a whole stressful situation. So we do that. People back home are getting reports that like, hey, we're still being delayed. We're still stuck in the airport. Da, 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 da. Okay, now we're leaving. I had friends and family showing up to Miami to cheer. And so they're all adjusting their schedules and trying to figure out like, okay, we're going to go back to our hotel or back home to sleep for a bit while you're up in the air and then come out. And people figuring out like, okay, now I can't really come and cheer while you're like, you know, for the whole time, but I might be able to like wake up early and come see you when you finish and, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. And I don't know any of this is happening because they're all just figuring this stuff out for themselves.
Yeah.
But so many of us, it first thought like we're on our way to our final one in Miami. Many of us are American, but also for people who aren't, like it's the last one. So if somebody's going to come, like that's kind of the best candidate.
Yeah.
So we get to Miami, we land, and we're in the last, and most of us are still dirty from Marathon 6. And so we like slept in that on the plane. And then we get to, and then we basically like get on a bus and we go to Miami Beach and it's dark and we see all our friends and family, but they're like, we're starting within 15 minutes or like mm-hmm. 10 minutes or something. So get ready, get to the start line, let's go. And we did. And so I did that one as an alligator.
Mm. Perfect.
Which I'm not sure I ever mentioned. Antarctica was a penguin. So, but yeah, so I did as an alligator. I had like a long alligator head on top of me. And I was like, all right. And at this point, of course, like I had said before the thing hundreds of times to people is like, you know, if I show up, as long as I get to the start line of the last one, I'm finishing. I could like snap my leg in half and I will finish that race. Yeah. Right. Like nothing is going to stop me from finishing the last one. And the truth is like, I felt really bad going into the seventh one. And then I basically every single step of it felt better as I went. So, whatever was happening with my left leg in Brazil did not come back. So, you know, my back pain from several days prior had like slowly gone away. I was tired. I was not going to pick up the pace a lot. Like every time I tried to pick up the pace, my legs were just like, no, you can't do that. Like, we just can't go that fast right now.
Yeah.
But it wasn't painful. It was just the sort of a, no, you can't.
Yeah.
So it was great. It was five laps out and back on Miami Beach. I had actually been to that area before. I had friends cheering for me, like when we started, friends seeing me on each lap. One friend came and basically met me at mile 20 and did like 2 miles with me, just to kind of keep me company. And he's like, all right, you've got 4 miles left. You've got this. Like this is, you know, it's between a 5K and a 10K. Like you've got almost nothing left. So,
yeah.
So I did that, and brought it home and finished. And it was kind of just this amazing feeling crossing that finish line. When I had started that last lap, my mom had shown up with my aunt and some close family friends who live nearby. And that's cool because my mom had actually never been to a race that I'd run before. So, so it was the first race she'd ever been to. And I was like, okay, I've got one more. So that was fun. And it was just this amazing like party atmosphere in the middle of Miami, kind of in the middle of the morning while it's dark, that we were all just celebrating and so on. And yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah.
That's
incredible. I mean, yeah, I can't imagine like, you know, I've done much, much shorter races and I feel a sense of accomplishment every time I finish one.
Yeah. So. As you should. That's the big thing. And it's one of my biggest, like, you know, a lot of people who I've gotten to know or only kind of vaguely know acquaintances on Instagram, they'll reach out and they'll tell me like, oh, this is inspiring. And we all do this comparison game thing. That's not, especially in like, that certainly happens in running, but it happens just in all kinds of things where you kind of diminish your own feats, like, because you see what other people do. And I love like, it's just like, that's a losing mentality. Like everybody loses in that mentality. Right. Cause it's like, no matter what you do, so there's a thing that I tell people that's like it sounds negative, but I bet I mean it in a positive way, which is like, no matter what you do, almost none of us is ever going to be the first or the best at something. So anything you do, any big achievement, you're suddenly the least accomplished person to have done that because everybody else who's done that like before you has had time to do something else. Right. Mm-hmm. And so like, there's no point in doing anything except for appreciating the achievement you just pulled off. Right. Mm. And just do that, like enjoy it, appreciate it for what it is, because everything is significant. Like the number of people who are like, oh, I'm not a real runner, I just do a 5K every once in a while. I was like, well, do you feel good after the 5Ks? Do you feel accomplished? Like, was it a big deal to you at some point? Well, every 5K is significant, right? Like, you know, and that's what it is. And that you have people who kind of really undersell themselves. And it's like, you know, there are people who are more, have much more natural ability and so on than I do, who will never get the opportunity to do this. And because so much of everything, it's not just ability, it's also opportunity, right? And so like, and people have lives and commitments and all kinds of stuff. And it's like, just appreciate the things that your combination of ability and opportunity have had, and your achievements are significant. And so for me, it's like, I'm getting to meet a bunch of this group who ran this together. We're meeting in March for a race in Antelope Canyon, Arizona. And I have pulled myself from the race because I was like, I'm just not feeling doing a 100-miler or a 50-miler. And it's just not where my headspace is in. And I don't need to do that. I can just go see these people and appreciate them for who they are. I don't need to keep up, right? I can do my own thing. I want to get faster again, so I'm going to focus on that. And like, you know, again, one of the guys who did it, like, he won the whole thing. He's a professional. If I'm trying to compare myself to the people who are way more, who are way better at running than me, who did this thing, well, they're just going to compare themselves to him. And like, that's not a, like, we all lose in that. Cause he has people who are faster than him and so on. So instead it's just like, no, just figure out what achievements you want to shoot for. Do your best to get there. Appreciate them when you do. And I really love that. I think the running community is better at that than most, at like kind of working against that negative kind of self-talk and so on, and recognizing like your achievement is yours. And we celebrate other people's for being theirs.
Yeah.
So it was a lot. I do have a fun aftermath story though, hotel situation. So,
okay.
So because our flights have been delayed and so on. After the race, I got my mom and my aunt, my family friends took me to breakfast. And the only place we could find that was already open was Burger King. So we're like, all right, whatever. I just need food. I need salt, fat, sugar, whatever. And so we did that, ate it. And then they took me to my hotel, which I had reserved, who knows, like 6 months in advance. Right. And I go to the hotel and the woman's like, oh no, we categorized you as a no-show. I was like, well, I was in the air from Brazil, so there's nothing I could have done to tell you that I was still coming, and I'm here, and the next day hasn't ticked over yet. Like, you know, so she's like, yes, you're right, the next day hasn't ticked over, so you're clearly not a no-show, so there will be no penalty. But the fastest way for me to get you into a room right now is if you make a brand new booking this second and like in front of me, tell me your confirmation number and I will put in a request to make you the top of the list. And I was like, all right, we'll do that. So, and she's like, clearly is feeling for me, right? Like, she is on my side. She wants to resolve this. And so so I do that. And then she's like, all right, well, I don't know. Like, it's out of my hands now. I've done what I can. It's up to whoever manages the thing to see if they'll follow through on it. And so I'm sitting in the lobby in like two marathons worth of just grossness. I feel so bad for everyone who's walking in and I don't want to be here. And I'm like, I'm wearing my short shorts that I had under my costume and so on. And just like, just feel disgusting and tired. And I'm like trying not to just collapse and falling asleep on this chair. I intentionally put myself in like the least comfortable chair possible, so I won't fall asleep. And I've got like my stuff all around me and like bundled up. Thankfully I had been able to send my mom off with my suitcases so she could fly home. I just made sure that so I only had my carry-on bags to reduce what I would fly home with a few days later. And finally, like, she gets, like, a couple hours go by, but it's still like before the day would really start, like very much a very early check-in. And I get the text and she's like, oh good, okay, you are the first check-in of the day. I'm glad they did that. So I get up to the room, take a shower, and just pass out. And it's like, at this point, you know, it's an early check-in, but it's daytime. And I sleep for like 8.5 hours. and I wake up and I'm like, all right, well, now I'm starving. So I go down, I find an Argentinian restaurant nearby that has really high rating. So I get like, spend an hour there just devouring everything I can possibly order and eat, and talking to the bartender and like grabbing drinks. And that's like a half mile away. And I'm like, oh, I have a new limp now. I wonder why. And so then I walk back to the hotel and like brush my teeth and then just go right back to sleep and sleep overnight for another like 8.5-9 hours. And I wake up and then that's when like things start to feel off. So One thing I had not shared is that pretty quickly we start to notice on the flight from Cape Town to Perth, just between marathons 2 and 3, is like there are a couple people on the plane who are not looking too good. Like, this is not fatigue. This is something else. And it's like, oh, they're sick. So when we get to Perth, somebody looks it up on the internet and they're like, oh, there's like this 24-hour bug going around Cape Town. And so that is clearly just coming around with us on the plane, on the group, because once somebody has it and you're in such close quarters so consistently, like, that's going to be a thing. And so,
and I can't imagine everybody's immune systems are at top form right now.
Exactly. And that's one thing for people who don't do distance running. One of the things that you learn is it is very common to get sick right after a marathon because your immune system is depressed after that kind of that kind of an effort. And that's when you're not just sitting on a plane with the same people like every single day in that time frame. And when people say 24-hour bug, it's like there's no magical 24-hour number. That's just like assuming healthy immune system, you know, you're doing what you need to do, you're resting, you're taking fluids, you're eating properly, and so on. This is, you know, this is not a you're running a marathon each day in that time frame and you're struggling to stay significantly hydrated because you're sweating it out while you're running and you're getting unpredictable meals and so on. So for it basically went through a lot of the plane and I did not get it. So it was really like a 3 to 5 day span that people seemed to have it.
Yeah.
And I had escaped this to this point. So I finally wake up after this almost like, you know, full day of sleeping plus meal. Right. And I'm like, oh, I don't feel so good.
Yeah.
And so it starts then. And for me, thankfully, because of all that sleep and the rest, and I was able to just do anything, I basically slept it off the following day. And it was a 24-hour thing. Like 24 hours later, I was like, oh, I feel fine now. So so I'm glad it held off, because some people just, it was brutal seeing them go through that while also kind of, you know.
What were the age ranges of the folks participating in this?
Oh, that's a good. So the youngest, I mean, for the full marathon, it was just standard age adults. I there was probably someone in their older 20s, maybe, but I was honestly, I mean, what, I'm 37 now, so I was 36, so mid-30s. I was probably at the younger end, because money is a factor for this trip, right?
Right.
So,
yeah, I did want to know if you wanted to talk about the
finances of it. Definitely talk about that in a minute. But I would say that I was probably on the younger end of the marathoners, but not the youngest, certainly. Although for the half marathon option, we had 2 13-year-olds actually who did half marathons every day, and were very much feeling it at the end. it's a pretty brutal endeavor for somebody that young.
Yeah.
And the oldest, though, we had Dan, who I want to say, was this his 80th birthday celebration? He was 78 or 80.
Wow.
So pretty incredible. And he did not get into the running thing until he was later on in life.
That's inspiring.
Yeah, very much so. And this was not his first time doing it. So this was his second time doing it. And he is hoping, I want to say it's not his 80th, because I think he wants to come back for his 80th and do it again. So that's so pretty incredible. I think his story was he was hoping to do this with his grandson, who is 18, but Dan's daughter, the grandson's mother, was not having it. He's like, nope, you know, he's going to college. You can do it later. So I was like, all right. So we were very much celebrating Dan. And of course, like, Dan was generally the last person to finish, but like, who cares, right? So we were very, like, at the end of many of the races, we were all just there waiting for him to, like, where when we could, when we weren't pushed on because of travel and so on, we would sit there and wait. And he was so fun. Like, and he had this Bluetooth speaker where he would just like rock out his classic rock jams. And so
nice.
Very frequently when one of us was going to like pass him on a lap, we would stop and chat with him for a bit before we continued and so on. So really inspiring, really fun guy to talk to.
Yeah.
So pretty large, upper 70s down to 13. So,
wow. And then, what are the, if somebody is listening to this and like, I want to do that, you know, what are the costs and commitments involved?
Yeah. So I would say, even if we don't get to the money, I would say that one of the things to see, so I mentioned the Disney running thing, and the thing I do in January, every January, it's called the Dopey Challenge. It's part of the Walt Disney World Marathon weekend, and it's 4 races back to back, 5K, 10K, half marathon, full marathon. there are a lot of people who do that every year. I do that every year. Like, I think I've done it 7 years now. And it's a lot. You wake up early every day because the races start at 5 a.m. It's a big accomplishment. And it's a lot more than just doing a marathon. And I have a lot of people who've got in their heads, they're like, okay, well, I've done Dopey. This is a lot more than that, but like, how much more? And it's like, these are just not comparable situations, right? And I've done a 50 miler too, and it's not comparable. I think anybody who's done a 100 miler could certainly physically do this. But one of the things I did in training was, because this started kind of January 31st through February 6th was the running of it. So my last long runs, if you will, before the taper was the Dopey Challenge, which is like almost 50 miles in 4 days. And the week before that, I did a race series in Florida that they let you choose. You can do as many marathons. They have it's also a 7 day thing, and they have a half marathon and full marathon every day in the same location. But otherwise, like, you can just sleep at a hotel nearby. The races start at the same time. There's no chaotic travel or anything like that.
Right.
It was right between Christmas and New Year's. So I went down and did 3 days in a row just to be like, what is it like to run three marathons in 3 days, to get a mental check and kind of be my peak. And I did a little bit of other running before that and after that in the week at home in Atlanta, especially because I had family around here and needed to do stuff with them. I got an idea for what it felt like and realized, oh, I need to slow these down, like slow down my effort. So I did those averaging. I think I did like the first one at 4, the second one at like 3:45, the third one at 3:45, like around the same thing. So I was like, all right, I definitely need to go slower than this. Right. Mm. And I kind of got that. The running 7 day marathons in 7 days in those conditions would have been absolutely nothing compared to doing the World Marathon Challenge. Like, so,
right.
So it's like the hardest component is the running, but it is like the plurality difficulty. It's by no means the majority of the difficulty for people who like to be precise with language. Right. Mm-hmm. So, so much of it is the mental wear and tear of not knowing if your travel is going to go off without a hitch, of being ready to kind of not being able to have a plan, right? Like, you have a loose plan, but one of the things they told us before we even started is we have a plan. Things are not going to go according to it.
Yeah.
Let go now. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if you can't do like, even I'm fine with going along with things, that was still very stressful. Right. Yeah. Like, I'm not a person who has trouble doing that. It was still very stressful to me. The complete inconsistency of food and so on, like, it went, anybody who does these things, like, it's drilled into you. You have to fuel yourself properly. It's like, you are not going to fuel yourself properly during this challenge. It's not going to happen. Period. Mm-hmm. Right. You're not going to get the sleep you need, like, or that you should get. You're not going to sleep comfortably, you know, and you're not going to be surrounded by people you know and love, right? Like, you're not going to have that support from people. Like, you're going to try and get it in, like, online beforehand, and that's going to be meaningful if you have that kind of remote network, but it's not going to be the same way. Like, you will make friends on the trip, but they're going through the same thing you're going through, right? Yeah. And that's a different kind of support than somebody who's just fresh and is able to be there for you, right? So all that combines, like, it's worth noting that if you've done something else, like, it's so much more than, it's like a rough hiking trip in combination with running seven marathons in 7 days.
Right.
It's that sort of thing. And, you know, I've talked to friends, I have no personal experience with this, but I've talked to friends who are in the military. They're like, it sounds almost like one of those boot camp experiences combined with a full marathon every day. Right. And it's like, yeah, kind of, it's just like, you wake up when you're told to wake up, you run when you're told to run, you eat when you're told to eat, and you do it with whatever's available, right? Mm-hmm. And you're doing this at an older age, likely because of the cost. Right. So the cost is, when I did it, and it has gone up, when I did it, it was 46,000 euros to do it. And so I got a one time, I don't just have that kind of money lying around. I had a one time windfall, and I decided, and this had been a dream of mine for a while, and I had always kind of had it, like, I had just started a savings plan, like, literally 2 months before I got my windfall. I was like, 2 months earlier, I was like, you know what, I should start a savings plan so that in a decade, you know, I can do this World Marathon Challenge thing, because it's been on my bucket list for a long time and I'm not making progress towards it financially. So let me start now.
Yeah.
And that was already on my mind. And then, and I'd had, I had just recently met some people who had done it for the very first time by coincidence. And they're like, oh, you already know what it is and already have it on your bucket list. I was like, yeah, let me pull up the, my phone note that's like 8 years old or however many years old it was at the time. And they're like, oh, you're not just like you. They're like, look, just telling you now, if you ever get the chance, you do it. Don't hesitate. And I was like, and so that was all freshly in my mind when I suddenly got a windfall and I was like, well, I guess I know what I'm doing with that. So
yeah.
So I made it happen, you know, 8-10 years earlier than I expected to be able to do it. But because of that, again, most of the runners are older because it's like, oh, they have the disposable income to drop $50,000 plus dollars, right? Because it's $46,000, which it's funny because if I had spent the money, if I had sent the money like 3 months, 4 months later, the exchange rate would have been heavily in my favor versus where it was when I did it. So so that was $49,000 at the time that I spent. And that was without me booking my flight to Cape Town, my hotel in Cape Town, booking my hotel in Miami, booking my flight home. There were small like additional, they definitely had meals for us on flights and stuff like that. And you know, they had fuel available for us, but like I bought gear, right, to, for it. Now, granted, everything I bought for it is stuff that I can reuse later. But I also bought extra meals, like when I was in the airports and I was like, you know what? I just really, they have food here that I want to eat. I'm going to go for it. Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
So like there were little incidental costs. So it's an expensive trip and that's a, it's a big outlay. Yeah. So quite a bit.
Yeah.
So unlikely I'll do it. People always ask me if I would do it again. And I was like, absolutely. But I'm not paying for it again,
right?
You know,
right.
So
crowdfund it.
Yeah. It, well, if I could, and I've always felt bad about that. Like, we all know people who have raised money to run a race, and I have never done that. Like, I've never gotten into a race via a charity bib. I've always gotten in under my own means somehow. And then I do raise money a lot when I'm running, but the idea is, like, I'm using this as some big thing I'm doing, but all of the money you're doing is not serving me in any way. It's just going to the charity. I don't think there's anything wrong with, like, I think it's a good way for charities to raise a lot of money. And I think it's great that races construct their, a lot of their spots around that, but it's just not how I do things. And so I would never crowdfund something like this. But if I were to be sponsored, I would take it, you know, for sure. I don't know how I might go about that, but who knows?
Well, that's very cool, Michael. And I mean, I still do think it's a cool way to see the world, even though you're only getting to sort of see this one little postage stamp that you're on for most of them. But it's still, it's a, you can say that you've been to all seven continents. And,
And I can say I did it in a week. I was in all seven continents in the space of a week.
Yeah.
I can also say, so there's this really funny moment where we landed in Miami. And I pulled out. So when we were in South Africa in the airport, I had bought a bunch of, it's the only place where I got cash because I was there for several days in advance. I was like, well, I don't need to take any of this cash home with me.
Right.
So I spent all my remaining cash on like junk food, like chips and, you know, and candy and stuff like that. But stuff that I knew that was sealed that I would be able to take from place to place with me. And I was slowly eating it. And I get to the end of the trip and I'm like, this might be the only, like, this might be the only Toblerone bar that has been to six continents in 6 days. Like, this might be the only bag of salt and vinegar chips that's been to six continents in 6 days, right? Yeah. Like, it was just like a fun little thing to think about. And we just, you know, some of the people on the trip with me started to joke about that because I would pull out, like, we landed in Miami and like, anybody want to eat the last bit of this before we start our last race? And they're like, where'd this come from? This is, is this a South African bag of candy? I was like, it is. They're like, oh, no way.
Nice.
So
that when we travel, I always kind of try to mark down where my Birkenstocks have been. Because they're nice. Like my shoes that I wear. Like if we go for a hike, then when we're done with it, right, I'm into my Birkenstocks just to let the feet breathe. And so, you know, they've been in Israel and the UK and Italy and Iceland. And so
I love that.
Yeah. And then every couple of years I get the soles replaced. So
We also, a fun thing, since we flew in and out of Antarctica, when we landed in Cape Town, we had an optional option. They put an Antarctica stamp in our passports if we wanted it, which of course, I think the only people who didn't do it were the people who didn't realize they had the choice to do it. So, so it's fun to have like a little Antarctica stamp in my passport.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, cool, Michael. Thank you so much for joining me for this. And, you know, I've been wanting to talk to you about this for about a year.
We talked about it last year and I was very much all over the place in terms of communication at the time.
Yeah, but it made sense. I felt like as we were getting toward the year anniversary of it, then maybe we can hook that up. So
No, yeah, it was great. Thanks so much for having me on. It was great to talk about it again. And it was great to just talk to you again for the first time in a while.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's always great catching up with old podcast friends, old internet friends. All right. Well, thank you so much, Michael. I'll try and get this up on the anniversary if I can. And yeah, I hope we'll talk again soon. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Michael. He's somebody that I've enjoyed talking with over the years, really enjoyed kind of interacting with him on podcasts. And when he did this challenge, I thought, I just want to know, like, what is this like? And I figured maybe podcast listeners would find that entertaining as well. So I hope you did. I do want to let people know that the Hugo nomination period is open right now, only for about another month or so. So if you want to nominate this podcast, perhaps not for this episode, since it wouldn't be one that would qualify for a Hugo Award. But I have enough science fiction related ones that the podcast still does qualify. So if you'd like to throw my podcast into the nomination bin, I'd appreciate it. And I think I'll leave it at that for today. So thank you so much for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye.